Hi, welcome to the UCB Theater Podcast. Sitting across from me is Will Hines.
Yeah, sitting across from me is John Frusciante.
I'm giving up the convention of saying what volume.
Because you never know how many episodes.
Because I never know, and who cares.
Actually, I do know. This is number 40.
It is?
Yep, this is number 40.
Well, now I can't give it up.
Sorry.
It's okay.
Our guest today is Matt Besser. Hello, Matt.
Hey, guys. you know, people should suspend disbelief, but to be honest, you're not sitting across from each other.
Oh, yeah.
We're adjacent. I'm sitting across from you guys, yes. But you guys are touching each other's knees and kind of next to each other.
That is true. Sitting adjacent to me is John Frusciante.
I just don't want to rip off the audience and tell them we're sitting away that we're not sitting.
Because they'd probably sense the lie in a little bit and we'd lose credibility.
They can hear where people are sitting.
Yeah, so it's important to own up to that.
All right, sitting next to me is
See?
That's right. Yeah, sitting across.
I feel better. I actually feel lighter now that I'm not keeping up this lie.
Truth is coming.
So we are recording this podcast in the middle of the Del Close Marathon, number 13. We're almost exactly in the middle of it, actually.
Yeah.
This is Saturday afternoon, 13th time the Del Close Marathon has happened. And so we've all been doing shows all night, and we're in the middle of a good time and feeling ragged.
Yeah,
and definitely. We're glad that Besser's in from L.A., so we get a chance to interview him. And thanks for doing this, Matt.
Excuse me if I get a little phlegmy.
Sure.
But that's because, once again, of last night.
Yeah, staying up all night. Yeah, no problem.
That's how it works.
So what are we going to do here, John? What's our plan?
So,
let's say who Matt is.
Matt Besser is one of the founding members of the Upright Citizens Brigade, one of the founders of the UCB Theater.
Yep, and one of the most active members of the theater.
That's right.
And, in terms of like helping, one of the main reasons that it's become successful and one of the main... brains that have shaped the personality and direction of the theater.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought when you said active, you meant I'm out there playing tennis, working out a lot.
Like just physically active. Hiking. Yeah. He's like a real outdoorsy guy in addition to his role.
I mean, we will
get
into all that, of course.
Okay.
As a member of the UCB, he's also helped to create the Comedy Central sketch show with the UCB.
That's right.
Created Crossballs.
Yes. Created Stung with Method Man and Redman. I love that show. And has been seen in numerous television shows and films.
Member of the classic or the famous improv group The Family from Chicago.
Yeah.
Improv nerds. Love to hear about The Family. We'll ask you about that in a little bit.
Because I love to hear and talk about them.
Yeah. So, Matt, what we're going to do today is kind of ask you a little bit about the early days of your personal comedy history, how you got into it, and then we'll see where that goes, and then we'll get into some improv theory stuff later.
You started as a stand-up comic, right? You're originally from Arkansas, and you started as...
Yeah. I went to college. I'm born in Arkansas. I went to college in Amherst. That's in Massachusetts. And during college, I had a radio show. It was like a punk rock radio show. And the banter in the radio show kind of started to take more time away from the songs. The music played as every week went by until I was basically doing prank calls and just getting drunk and screwing around with my friends. And all of a sudden I was like, hey, I'd like to... do this. Yeah. And I was actually starting to listen to Howard Stern. People were sending me cassette tapes of a Howard Stern show. And I think in my mind, I was like, I want to be like Howard Stern.
Yeah.
But then I did a stand-up contest in college. And it was for a trip to Jamaica, if you won. It's like a Cool Ranch Doritos sponsored travel national contest. And my friend and I, my writing partner, Eric Sicklin, my current writing partner and roommate at the time, we entered it, and he did really well. He kind of had this Bill Cosby kind of straight-ahead act. And then I went up, and I was so nervous and stuttering. I came off like a Bobcat Goldthwait kind of act, even though that wasn't my intention going out there. The audience thought I was just this crazy, weird, wild guy, and I actually got a really good response. It was a huge audience, too. It was like 2,000 people in this huge room. So after you've had 2,000 people laugh at you, you get the bug to want to do stand-up. So after college, I had a friend living in Boulder, and I went to stay with him for the summer and meanwhile started doing open mics in Boulder and in the clubs in Denver. And this is during the middle of the stand-up boom in the late 80s and early 90s. And Chicago was one of the meccas for stand-up, so I moved there after that summer, and I'd never heard of improvisation at all. I knew about Second City from SCTV, but I didn't really get what it was necessarily, and I definitely had never seen improv or heard about it. So I went to see some shows. I saw an Improv Olympic show. Tim Meadows, Chris Farley were in the show. This group called Blue Velveeta, and it blew me away.
Really?
And even though I'd been doing stand-up and kind of doing a Bobcat, Andy Kaufman-esque type of persona myself and having a good time with it, I never felt like stand-up was exactly my thing. And once I saw this improv thing, I might have seen short form a little bit before I saw long form, and I did not dig it too much. But then when I saw it, it just came off a little, I don't know, lame.
Yeah.
I could use other adjectives, but when I saw long form, I was like, wow, I can't do this. Like other stuff, you see stand up, you're like, I could do that. You see short form, you're like, I could definitely do that. But the long form, I was like, I can't see how they're doing that. I really don't understand how they did what I just saw. And I thought they were cheating. And I went up and asked a couple of them, that one improvised. You guys have done that one before, right? Because you just fell into it and it was hilarious right away. And there's no way you haven't done that before. And they're like, no, we haven't done that before. I'm like, you're lying. And I probably for a month I thought that they were lying and people had their bags of tricks and groups did their little things.
So you liked it right away. I think that's interesting because I find that in New York here I'll meet stand-ups where they hear about the UCB and they'll come see a show or two and they really have their arms folded.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not always won over at first. And they're really suspicious of it. They like the discipline and the conciseness of stand-up or something, like joke writer types. Mm-hmm. And they'll be sort of like, or maybe they'll see like a not great improv show.
Yeah, that's possible.
Yeah.
If you see not great improv, Jesus, who wants to do that?
Yeah.
But I saw Blue Velveeta, which at the time they were really coming into their own.
And who was on Blue Velveeta? Is that Brian Stack? I forget which one they were. No, I get them mixed up like with Jazz
Stack
Freddy.
Stack wasn't in that group, but Kevin Dorff was.
Okay.
And Jay Leggett and Mitch Rouse and Tom Booker, Susan Messing, Brendan Sullivan.
Right. So these are real heavy hitters. Great people.
Yeah, and like I said, they're really peaking. Like, I think just as I saw them, they're really coming into their own. There were many teams there, and they were actually not the oldest team either at that point. But I think right when I saw them is when everyone was looking at them as, ooh, this group has found themselves. Like, Farley's group was great, but it was almost because Farley was on it. It wasn't because it was such a great team thing.
Yeah.
Like, after that show, I was like, oh, that fat guy won the show.
Yeah.
I thought there was a winner on every group, and he won that round.
Yeah.
But then later I realized, no, he kind of just hogged the stage. It was really funny.
Yeah.
So how long from there is it that you start taking classes?
Probably immediately.
Okay.
And once I took one, I took every class in town. There was Improv Olympic, Second City, and Second City had this place called the Players Workshop. I'm not sure if it's still around.
Kevin Mullaney was telling us about that. That was like intro classes or something.
When I moved to Chicago, I knew I wanted to get into sketch. I didn't know what improv was yet. But so I looked at the map of where Second City was, and I was like, I'm going to live as close to Second City as possible. Unfortunately, I didn't really use the mile scale thing, so I actually ended up being way, way far away from Second City. I didn't really understand Chicagoland yet. And when I moved to Chicago, I was staying in this motel that was so far away from where I ended up eventually, but it was funny that I thought I was moving to a place that I'm only an inch away from Second City here.
Yeah.
That's 40 miles or something. I took Players Workshop, The Annoyance, and Improv Olympics simultaneously. So I took classes from all of them at the same time because I just wanted to get into this. And they were all vastly different, and I didn't understand that everybody was on a different page. You kind of assumed as a beginner that all these teachers were teaching the same thing.
Yeah.
And they were using the same language, but they weren't teaching the same thing. And
right.
It took me probably about 2 years to realize that.
Yeah.
Like, for a while, I was like, I'm just not getting it. Like, this guy explains yes and this way, and this other guy explains it this way, and this guy is talking about emotion, and this guy's talking about relationships.
Yeah.
I think I was just one confused puppy, and I think most people were.
Yeah.
And I wonder if I'd just taken one... I don't even know if I'd just stuck with one theater, if that would have made it better. I'm not sure of that either, because even from class to class, teacher to teacher, I don't think... Because it was a real boom happening there, too, you know, in addition to the stand-up, improv was really starting to grow then.
Yeah.
And it took me a while to get to Dell, really, to the guy where you're like, oh, here's the guy who knows what he's talking about.
Right.
Yeah. And not just pretending to know what he's talking about.
How did you feel you were sort of, like, doing, like, as a student? Were you getting, like, validation or encouragement from teachers? They're like, oh, yeah, you're good, you're funny, or was it all just self-driven?
Well, that's the thing. You can't take away or give funny, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I was on stage doing stand-up and being funny, so I knew I was funny. I was out in front of crowds, and a lot of people in my class weren't even doing that,
right.
You know? And Sharon even told me, I remember early on, she's like, oh, you do stand-up, you're probably not going to work out here. Most stand-ups don't work out.
Yeah.
Because they're in their own head, and they're already they're used to getting laughed by themselves.
Controlling, so they want to control the whole act themselves.
Yeah.
They go for jokes way early.
So I knew I was funny, and you know what? That was probably my biggest problem, because my first big epiphany as an improviser was listening, like getting... Oh, all I have to do is listen to what the other person is saying and try to hear what they think is funny and what we should do together. It took me so long to get that. Like, for so long, I was always just coming up with premises in my own head based on the suggestion, not based on anything else. But, like, I'd hear the word, and then I'd go right to my head going, what premise does that make me think?
Yeah.
And if my guy... wasn't on board with my premise, the scene wasn't going to happen, especially if I thought I was funnier than the other person.
Right.
And
I think it's a common phase for a lot of people to go through that.
Yeah. And I just thought, you know, most of the time is like, these people aren't as funny as I am, and that's why the scene isn't happening until I start getting some good teachers pointing it out to me. Look, you're not listening to what that person just said.
Do you have memories of specific breakthrough moments? Some people can remember, like, scenes or shows where, like, oh, this was a huge thing, and they, oh, what do you remember?
Yeah, definitely. I took a class with Scott Robinson at the Annoyance, and it was just that. It was just him saying... look, just, it sounds so simple to say, like a listener could go, that's all, that's your epiphany, but it was like, hey, did you not hear what he just said?
Hmm. It is.
Huh? What?
Right, and there's something about that that sort of clicks in your brain in that moment. It's like, oh, this is what I'm supposed to be doing.
Yeah, and I became so much better, like almost really overnight. It was truly an epiphany because... and people started to notice. Like, I remember Miles saying to me, what happened to you? Like, why are you so much better all of a sudden? Like, I think I'd done well on stage just because I could come up with funny premises by myself and force them, and every once in a while.
It would land, it would work out.
That would create a good scene, and people would go my way. But if it wasn't going my way, or it wasn't my premise,
you had
scene
no backup
wasn't
plan.
Good,
yeah.
Or I'd get lost. And then Dell had another in a Dell class, probably a year or two even after that. I got, and this is when I'm on The Family and we're doing really well and I'm feeling really good about my improv. I went back and took a class with him, just kind of to tune up. But really, what I was doing, I was going back to show off. I was like, I'm gonna go do a Dell workshop and show off.
Yeah.
And he called me out in the. In the middle of the scene, he was like, you're not respecting this guy you're on stage with right now. You're ignoring his initiate. And I was like, you know what? You're right. I totally was. So even the lesson I'd already learned, I needed to kind of get retaught again now that my ego had built up.
Who were your favorite teachers? We want to talk about Dell, definitely. But before that, do you remember other teachers that stood out as really great ones? Or maybe you took so many?
For their different reasons. I mean, like I said, Scott, he gave me that epiphany. So he was a good one. I'll tell you, I did not have very many good teachers. Mm-hmm. I wish the Players Workshop would refund the year of classes I took from them. It was a complete ripoff.
Okay.
I was taking classes where we would spend the entire class just doing object work exercises. Just you're in a shower, close your eyes, feel the hot water.
It's like straight up acting shit.
I guess. I never really went down that road.
Yeah, so that's like stuff that we used to do in acting class in college.
You're walking through lava. The lava hardens. You can't pull your feet. And at the end of class, I'm like, what the fuck did I just do? How am I learning anything? Right. How does this help me? It was just either they were being lazy or they didn't really have anything to teach. But there was McNapier. He was a great...
Okay.
Our philosophies don't completely line up, but I think he was... in particular, a great guy to have early on.
I've heard people describe him as being able to assess people pretty early, this is the kind of person you are and the type of habits you probably have.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard people say that he's quick about that.
And that whole thing about getting out of your head, that is such an important thing early on in your improv, and I think he helped me do that. I can't think of a particular class now I'm officially out of my head.
Right.
And some people can be out of their head from fear. I think mine more was from ego. I was in my head going, I'm so funny, I'm going to come up with a great concept, and while I'm doing that, I'm completely missing everything that's happening on stage.
Sure.
I'm surprised to hear, I guess I shouldn't be, because you've devoted so much of your career to it, that you liked improv so much right away. I feel like for some people it takes a while to get won over. I'd like to hear about meeting the other UCB people. Mm-hmm. When did that happen? When did you meet Ian and Walden?
You performed with Ian on The Family first.
Actually, right? We performed on this group called Corky's Callback first. John Favreau was also on that group. When we first got to Improv Olympic, like I said, there was this group called Blue Velveeta. They became so great that they decided to take over the space that Improv Olympic was in and kick Sharna out. So there was kind of this little coup d'etat in the early 90s where Blue Velveeta just took over, and frankly they kind of deserved it. The entire crowd was coming there to see them. They were the only team that did consistently great work, and they realized that, and they're like, we don't need you, Sharna. They started their own space.
Wow.
Or they took her space and she had to go get
crazy
a new space. It was real ugly.
Wow.
And she's forgiven them, but at the time it was a it was a pretty ugly.
Yeah.
But for the young people, it was great because now the house team was gone and they needed a new house team. So that opened it up to all these new people that were coming in, like me, mm-hmm. and the groups I was on. And there was two groups, Corky's Callback and The Victim's Family were the two groups. And I was on Corky's. Pete Holney was also in that group. Corky's and Victim's Family were very, very competitive. I don't know if teams get as competitive as we were back then. When the other team was on stage, we were in the back just down talking. And that was status quo. Everybody did that. It was not a they get off and we go, hey man, great job. It was not that at all. Or if it was, that was totally phony. It was very competitive. Everyone wanted to be the next Blue Velveeta. You wanted to be the next house team. And I also like that competitive. I'm a big sports guy. I like competition. So I kind of thrived on that whole thing of who's going to be the next house team. At some point, I quit Corky's and went over to The Family because more of my friends were on The Family. You asked me where I met Ian. Ian came in just a little bit after me at Improv Olympic. When I first saw Ian, he looked like this. He looked like an athlete to me. I was like, who's the jock over there?
Yeah.
Who's that intense jock-looking guy who never smiles and is always sweaty coming off his bicycle? So I had this and no one thinks a jock's going to be funny right away. So
right.
I had this impression of that guy's no way he's going to be funny.
Right.
And are we talking about The Family right now, how I met them, or UCB?
Yeah.
So Adam McKay came in at exactly the same time I did. I was in his same class. We were in the same classes. And we were just becoming friends outside the theater. We had mutual interest in music and stuff like that. And eventually, just because we were friends hanging out, they're like, why are you on Corky's? Just come be on the victim's family.
Right.
And when I went over, that became a big thing too. Like the fact I was quitting one good group to go to the other one, that became a huge issue.
You went to the Red Sox from the Yankees or something like that.
Without question, it was exactly like that. And people were pissed. Really pissed. And Ian was still on Corky's, and eventually he came over, and then it was a war, and victim's family won. We became the better group. And then, unfortunately, one of our members, Rick Roman, this story is Del Close decided to start directing again. When we were there, and even the years before, he hadn't directed in a long time. He would come in and teach classes, but that would be the last you'd see of him. He wouldn't even really come to shows, even. And he was getting his creative juices flowing again, and he had some ideas, and we were clearly the best team. He said, I want to work with this group, the victim's family. We were very intimidated, very excited. We had our first rehearsal, and this rehearsal was to work on the movie long form. And it had never been done before, and he had had it in the back of his head for years, and he really wanted to develop it and make a show out of it in addition to some other forms he was thinking about. So we had a rehearsal, and it went terribly. We were all so intimidated, and he also wasn't quite clear on what the form was going to be either. And we had this terrible rehearsal, and afterwards we were like, oh my God, he's never going to direct this again. It was such a bad rehearsal. Mm-hmm. We all went our separate ways that night. It was a rainy, terrible rainy Chicago night. And our friend Rick, he drove a cab for a living. And there was this one dead-end street where the dead end on the other side of the dead end was Chicago River. And it was the street was not lit. And it was a torrential downpour. And he accidentally drove into the Chicago River and drowned. And it took us about 2 or 3 days to even figure that out.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Wow.
And because he was the type of guy who could just disappear anyway and come back a few days later. So when we didn't see Rick for a couple of days, it didn't strike us as weird. But then all of a sudden on the radio, someone was like, I heard on the radio a cab driver named Rick Roman drowned. We're like, well, that can't be our Rick. And we went down to the morgue. Armando, Adam, and myself, and that was Rick, and that kind of changed.
You guys identified, or is that right?
Yeah, it was terrible. I mean, I'll never forget that night. It's the first person I'd ever known that had died, besides like a grandparent, which is not, you expect grandparents to die.
Right.
So it was the first person I've ever known that had died, and it was just terrible.
Yeah.
Such a milestone in my life, and, just learning how to deal with that in a mature
way. Yeah,
like
1 minute
way.
You're in the back of a theater talking shit about another improv team in Chicago, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, that's all bullshit. Like, this is over. It could be over in a second.
And maybe it's just romantic or idealistic to credit Rick with us coming together, but in a way, we had a memorial for him. I don't know the timeline. It's probably a month later at Second City, ironically, on the ETC stage. But a lot of groups went up, like 4 different groups, I think, went up that night, including the premier group in town at that point, which was Jazz Freddy. Mm-hmm. And we went up, and we did our movie for the first time to the public, and we killed. We did this science fiction movie, and it just went... which also was very Rick and very us to pick science fiction. And it did great, and we did better than Jazz Freddy.
And you wanted to do it to show this is Rick's group, so you guys had to, like, for him kind of be good, right?
Yeah, I mean, we would have wanted to be good even if it had nothing to do with Rick, because we wanted to prove ourselves to the community. At this point, we weren't... Oh, I should say, as soon as he died, we were truly the victim's family.
Yeah.
Ironically, we dropped the word victim and became the family.
Right.
And then that night, it was really our coming out party. We honored Rick. we did great. We finally got some respect. Dell kind of had his comeback as an improv director. It was it was quite a
it's
night.
Crazy. It's an insane story.
Yeah, it was, and it changed everything. And it also gave us. Did it give us discipline? For whatever reason, we became very disciplined, where we were rehearsing all the time, multiple times a week. It's all we thought about. We really wanted the show to be great, so we devoted our lives to it.
So the family is you, Ian, Miles Stroth, Neil Flynn, Adam McKay, and...
Ali. And Pete Holney was in... the earliest version of the movie in the family, and then quit to go do an annoyance show, and we got so mad and we told him he couldn't come back, which we still joke around with him today. He did a show called Goomba, so every time we have a family reunion, we ask Pete if he's going to the Goombas reunion. But I love Pete, but we did when he abandoned us. Not let him back in.
I'm just remembering this now. Is there something about everybody having a chain link in their wallet or something like that? I've heard rumors about the family of like things that everybody had.
I think that was a later thing.
Oh, okay, okay.
But
I love Dell. I think it was Dell described you guys as a group of people falling down the stairs together and landing on your feet every time.
Mm-hmm.
You just had like this mad, frantic, expert kind of energy.
Well, I think it maybe it has something to do with the movie form itself. Maybe it had something to do with our sensibility. Maybe it had something to do with the fact that Blue Velvet had already become... It was hard to do the Herald, per se, better than they did it. They did it so well. And we wanted to become known for something or have our own thing. But we kicked ass at the movie. That became our first great form.
Yeah, I think I didn't realize that the movie and the family were so synonymous. I didn't know that that was like your...
You guys did Three Mad Rituals.
Yeah, right? Yeah. We know we're doing the Herald just like everybody else on Herald night, which was the only night, you know. But he had this new form, and he had tried it before, years before, but it just never had worked. And through rehearsal with us, We figured it out, and I remember that rehearsal too. I remember we were doing a baseball movie, or we were doing some movie, and he said, "Cut, cut, cut! You guys are trying to just parody it. You're trying to make fun of movies, and you have no right. You know, we should be loving movies. You love movies. Why are you trying to make fun of movies? When you put movies up on a honor the movie, put it up on a pedestal. So when you're going through the form, don't come off like you're saying how shitty these movies are, which is kind of, if you think about it, what a parody is. You're saying, look at how typical this thing is that I can show archetypes.
Yeah.
It's take the opposite. That's a half empty view. Take a half full view. This is how great Westerns are for this reason. This is a trope of a Western that's great for this reason. Take that attitude. We're like, okay, we get that. And then we did a baseball movie after he gave us that note, and it kicked ass. We're like, took things from every baseball movie.
I feel like that's very symptomatic or very typical of what improv is different than other comedy forms. Like, aim high, take the high road, love what you're doing, start more intelligent, not less intelligent, more capable, not less capable, more a higher assumption. That seems like right in line with other things that you learn when you're learning any improv.
Yeah, so that was a big, I think Dell, that was his eureka moment too. Like, he had struggled with the form, and I think he finally got how to teach it. We finally got how to do it. And so that's when people say, oh, the family created the movie. We're like, well, we didn't create it. It was Dell's idea, but we helped him. I definitely know we helped him develop it. And we were very proud of that, and we did it really well. I think we knew... That was another thing. We were all movie lovers, and we knew different genres. I don't think we were all... Like, I don't think Flynn's necessarily a sci-fi guy, but I am. I'm not a... I don't know, fireman movie?
all the great fireman movies, yeah. such a great genre.
But we... it was a good mixture, and I think that was perfect for us. It also so happened we were all about 6'2 to 6'5, or tall Flynn is, but we were all these like big guys.
Yeah, and fast, like you're fast thinkers, decisive.
Yeah, we had a few premise guys, you know. Me and McKay like to lay on the premise really heavy, but then we had some other guys that were very yes Andy,
right.
like Miles. So I think we had all different types of that too, but yet it all worked together. And then the tag out was something. I don't believe we invented it by any means, but we definitely used it more than anybody else at that time. And we just started going crazy with tag outs. It's like, okay, once you get bored of that scene, tag out, let's take it to another place. Keep hiding, tag out, take it to another place. And that started working into our Herald work. And of course, if you're tagging out and taking things to another place, you're kind of breaking the structure of the Herald, because that's why you have different beats of a Herald, is to take it to another place. You don't need tag outs. So, but we were taking, whereas in a Herald, you go to like, you know, three different places.
Yeah.
We were going to 20 different places with each premise.
Right.
And maybe we weren't exploring as much as we could have, but we were definitely heightening. And that became our signature style for the Herald. And we called it the Boneless Herald, since we were breaking the structure. So that became... Or is it Spineless? I forget.
Spineless, I've heard more.
Spineless Herald. And we, so that became the two things that we liked doing the most, the tag out really fast Heralds and the movie. And we also worked on the deconstruction with Dell and this thing called the Impressionistic Horror. And a form of the deconstruction called the Check-In. And what else? I think I'm missing one, but there were basically like six different forms we worked on.
The three, what was the three mad rituals? That was the Herald, the movie, and the deconstruction. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. All right.
So at this point, you guys become sort of the team. You guys are the new, like, the team that everybody is coming to see, mm-hmm. the team that's packing the house, mm-hmm. right?
Does that mean even that second city... Not having ever been in Chicago for any length of time, does that mean that even like the Second City community knew about it? I picture like a hierarchy where Second City, by virtue of being famous, is sort of like top dog in
a
way.
No, not at all, because they were the least advanced,
the most mainstream, and like.
Well, also they don't really. I think they got back into improv because of what Dell was doing, really.
Yeah,
and. We could get into when Dell died in my eulogy that spanked Second City.
I've heard about it.
But before what Dell was doing, in the time I was there, they weren't doing anything in improv. They would do the set after their sketch sets, and that was just really weak improv. You're basically just taking 20, 30 words. They would take... Can we get some suggestions from the audience? They would get 30 suggestions from the audience,
right?
And then just pick something and do a couple scenes. It just wasn't
so
impressive.
So improv was really Improv Olympic and the Annoyance and other places.
Yeah, so Second City was definitely not looked at as, oh, that's where they're doing the improv.
Right.
And there was a group called Ed, which came from Northwestern. Carlos Jacot, Chris Reed... I'm not sure if you know these guys, but...
I've heard of Ed in relation to, like... Is it, like, Foursquare? I've heard like, four, like I forget. They did, like, cool form stuff or something like that.
Yeah, they did... I forget the director's name, but... and they had something called Film Dome, and then John Lehrer and Chris Hogan did this show, a two-person show called The Chris Hogan Show. And they were really experimenting with form a lot. And with incorporating the space and using sound and a lot of stuff that wasn't being done with the Herald. And I think when Dell heard about that, he was like, oh, what's happening? And I think that kind of lit a fire under his ass a little bit that, oh, there are
somebody
other places really experimenting and taking this place. So he became big fans of those shows and said, hey, you know what? We need to be more experimental. We can't just rest on this Herald thing. Let's us try. So there was a lot of appreciation at that point. Whereas I was speaking of the competition within the Improv Olympic, I think there was more mutual appreciation between theaters.
Okay.
So we would go, and then there was Jazz Freddy, which became a marriage of that whole Northwestern Ed crowd with the generation above me, the Kevin Dorff generation of improvisers. They all joined together, Brian Stack, to make this Pete Gardner, this really large Jazz Freddy group. I think that had like 15 people in it.
Jesus.
And it was a great, great, great show.
Wow.
So that was a show everybody admired. Everybody admired the Northwestern shows. And you guys
now became a group that people watched.
Yeah, yeah. So we're all really cross-pollinating and ideas and looking at each other and taking each other's...
Whenever I hear about this time in Chicago improv history, it's amazing. I feel like there's a lot of good people working really hard and insular in a helpful way, like where they just... They're not thinking about TV deals, not directly at least, or movie deals or their own personas. Like, no, we're going to make a great improv show, and the measure of good improv show is that the Chicago improv community notices it.
There was zero thought about career. When I look back at that, I'm like, God, man, how opposite of where my head is at now.
And, yeah.
You know, even where our theaters are at now, that has something to do with Chicago. You're not really thinking...
Yeah, the entertainment industry isn't around.
Right,
it's just plays and Steppenwolf and like...
So it has something to do with Chicago, which I'm still... It still does. And it has something to do with that time period. It was like... There was the Herald, but that was pretty much the long form. And all of a sudden, was like, why does that have to be the only long form? And then it just became this explosion of creativity of coming up with other forms. And it's easy to come up with, you know, you just come up with a bunch of rules and parameters, come up with your own form, but to come up with a form that seemed to make sense and work and be different.
Yeah, a sense of theatricality, something that resonates with the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of that experimentation going on back then. And there weren't so many people. Like, people assume that the numbers were the way they are now, but it wasn't that way at all. Like, I felt like I knew everybody in the Chicago improv community. You know?
Right. And now it's impossible. Like, I don't even know everybody in the UCB network.
Oh, yeah. It's impossible to know everybody.
We should talk about Dell, I think.
Yeah. So you had a point that you wanted to...
Oh, I was saying I obviously did not know Dell. I hear about him anecdotally through a lot of people's stories. And I don't even necessarily know you super well, but I know you somewhat and for years. And it's surprising, it's pleasantly surprising to me that you kind of like were so moved and affected by this crazy hippie. I mean, it's like he seemed to me to be sort of a mystical, self-mythologizing, like grand, hippy-dippy kind of crazy person in a way. And you strike me as sort of unsentimental, like pragmatic, what's the payoff? What is the reason for this? How does this work kind of person? Mm-hmm. And that you were connected with him is a surprise to me. I'd like to know what it was about him that drew you so much to him.
All those words that you said of Dell work for me. I don't know if hippie dippy does. Like, that makes it sound
I'm acknowledging,
because there was so much of that. There was so much, because when I hear hippie dippy, that reminds me of the teachers.
Who are indecisive.
The coddling, no choice is a bad choice, which drives me fucking crazy.
Okay, right.
Because I went through so many years of that, of like, we're all doing great. And then my mind's like, no, man, we're not all doing great.
Right.
Come on, don't lie to me. We're not all doing great. Not everybody in here is funny, one. And two, not everyone in here is getting it.
Yeah.
So don't tell me every choice is a great choice.
Right.
Because if you lie to me about that, I can't believe anything.
Right. And Dell would call that out.
Right. So that's not very hippy dippy.
You're right.
Like, he's hippie-ish.
Maybe his attraction for like rituals and magic and that sort of
thing. That's what would take me to that. But when I think of hippy dippy, I think of someone who's like really nice and loving.
Soft
and he wasn't that at all.
So we'll edit those words out.
No, but that's a good... Because he does come from that generation.
Yeah.
And if you talk to his contemporaries, they'll tell you, you know, he could be a bastard. You know, he could be... But they love him. It's like, that's Dell.
So I guess I'd like to hear, you've said in other interviews, I'd like to hear you say what was special about him to you personally. Like when you met him and took class, what about him was like, oh, this guy's for real?
So many things. First off, we had similar interests, and science fiction being one of them. He was really into that, and he saw the books I was reading, and we would talk about that kind of thing. So just on that level outside of improv, we had similar interests. As far as improv goes, he was the first guy where I felt like, oh, there really truly is a methodology that he understands that I need to understand to learn this. Whereas
he's not just spouting mantras with brainless.
Right. And it took me a while to figure out that a lot of teachers were doing that. Like, I assumed everybody knew what they were doing when I moved there, as any student does. You hope that your teacher understands what they're talking about, but it took me a while to go, oh my God, people are saying the same words and meaning different things. Mm-hmm. And I was paying money. I didn't have much money. And you get pissed off when you're like, wow, I just took a second city class at this institution that's supposed to be so great.
Right. And I mean, I can hear in a lot of your opinions now things you talk about with the UCB, like things that must have influenced you when you were creating this theater.
We were like, that's why the curriculum is so important to us, and that's why making sure everyone on this is on the same page is so important to us. Right. You can call that fascist or like UCB has other rules, but that's what I wanted. I wanted someone that had a clear vision, and Del had that, and he wasn't just going to let you go on stage and do something and go, okay, that's great, next. He would say if it didn't work, and I liked that. I was like, finally, someone's telling
me. So he had good taste. He spoke to it. He had credibility in terms of this is good, this is bad. Mm-hmm.
And he would call you on your shit, and he wasn't out there just laughing. For better and definitely for worse, that's what I emulated in my teaching. The for worse part is I'm not a nice teacher. I'm not the teacher you go to feel good about yourself. I'm not out there to make you, okay, guys, that's great. I feel phony when I try to do that. I feel like a liar, and I know there's a place for that, but that's why I never do beginning levels anymore. I just can't do it. I have to be with people
who've got a thick skin and are just ready to, like,
and are advanced and have been through it and have already proven themselves on some level, and I like to work with people who are all good. I mean, it's
how about Del's what did he, so I get that what you're saying there about how he'd call you out on shit and he knew what was good and not, mm-hmm. and he was speaking to it directly. How about
let me say one more thing.
Sure, yeah, please.
Also, like you say, you're really pragmatic, and at a certain time, like when we first got with Del, it was all about experimentation, and he was that way until, from that point when we started with him until he died, every year he was coming up with a new form, you know. And it was all about experimentation. To me, at a certain point, it was like, okay, enough with the experimentation. Like, there was too much, in my mind, there was too many new forms. There's too many new openings. Especially when we moved to New York, that became almost like a virus. Like, people worried about coming up with a signature opening more than being worried about just being good at scene work. So right. That became kind of my own personal, fuck the new forms. Yeah. Anybody can come up with a new form. Let's do the scene work good. So that almost became like a New York thing for me versus a Chicago thing. In Chicago, I was all about experimentation, so I wanted to go along for it. When I came here, it was like, God, we've already invented so many forms. These people don't know how to do long form at all.
Right.
I don't think that's what our classes should be about, coming up with new long forms. Let's just teach the long forms already exist. The Herald's really hard to understand, so let's just.
And so it became more important to bring the basics to people rather than
because I just saw people being more concerned with having their group have its own thing and its own unique form than being a good group.
I still see that today with practice groups and, you know, with improvisers.
I'm sympathetic to both sides of it. I mean, mm-hmm. I can understand the urge to want to make your mark. But I can see where if you're doing it too early, you don't have a grip of the fundamentals, you're wasting your time.
Yeah, it could be more important to make your mark doing funny scenes than, like, doing them, like, creating a magic trick or an illusion.
Yeah.
You know?
And also I see there being a balance of teachers that way. Like, not every teacher has to have my mentality either. And I think of the four UCB, when we were the four teachers, we didn't all approach the classes the same way I did. So I think that's a good balance to have of different teachers have different goals, but hopefully are teaching the same thing.
What was it about Dell that was, like, inspiring? Like, some teachers just have a way of making you aspirational to, like, go for stuff more. Some people are more like nuts and bolts teachers, where I think they're like, let's just demystify everything and make it simple. And some teachers, you walk out and you're like, we're going to change art, sort of, or something. I feel like Dell is more
the
latter.
I spoke to this in the press conference yesterday, but he never cared how much his students knew. Like, he didn't go out there and go, oh, this is my advanced level, or this is my beginning level, or these people have been here 5 years, or these people have been here for a year. It was just whatever was on his mind, that's what was going to be, we're going to work on that day. Every week was a different experiment, and it usually came from something that occurred to them that week.
Right.
I was reading Socrates and in a dialogue with Plato, and I want to see, let's try a dialogue, philosophical dialogue. It's like, I don't even know how to who, what, where yet. But it's the guru, so you're just like, okay, let's do whatever he wants. And he didn't care that. It was never a follow-up on what we were working on the last week.
But these
based on what we did last week, we're going to go to the next step this week. No, it wasn't that. It was.
But these are good things you're saying. This has made it exciting and interesting?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, once again, it was a balance. I was getting, you know, Sharna was teaching the basics. And at that point, it wasn't a concern to me to... I was into experiment. Like I said, Chicago, I was in that mindset.
Right.
It was more when I became the teacher and I became the one responsible that I was not against experimentation, but didn't think that should be the forefront of what a student was into.
Were you teaching in Chicago? Or
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I taught a lot in Chicago. In fact, I got a little burnout even before we moved to New York. And I was experimenting and coming up, like I came up with the real world. I think the thing I started doing was mixing improv with written stuff. Mm-hmm. Or like the real world had established characters, and that's something that hadn't really been done that I was aware of, where you bring a character that's already established into the show, and then but the entire thing's improvised. So that became my little... experimentation.
Mm-hmm. Sean, I think you were saying that, Matt, a lot of the shows you've come up with... What were
you saying? Oh, yeah. Well, one thing that you brought to New York, definitely, that we still rely very heavily on in the way that we create shows and promote shows is having that hook.
Mm-hmm.
Having, like, a hook that will draw the audience in.
A good title.
Yeah, like having a good title, having something that, like, as we say, an audience member who's never been to the theater before will look at the calendar and think, I want to see that show. What do you think got you to the, like, you have a great mind for that. You seem to, you know, be very on top of that. What kind of drew you to
that? Well, yeah, and that's also goes back to Chicago. Like, our first show with Dell was called Three Mad Rituals. Our second one was called Dynamite Fun Nest. To me, Three Mad Rituals sounds kind of pretentious. It sounds like... It sounds a little too theaterish for me.
Mm-hmm.
That's a word.
Yeah.
Whereas Dynamite Fun Nest sounds fun. It sounds crazy. And it more described... It kind of described our improv. Oddly enough, that name... I don't know if this answers the question, but it's kind of an odd story. Dell had this thing called a word ball, which I think you can still order, but it's something that writers used to use, and it's a huge plastic clear ball that has every word in the dictionary in it, and they're just all separate, just little pieces of paper, different words.
Yeah.
In the computer age, that's a ridiculous concept, but back in the day, it was something to, if you got writer's block or got stuck, you'd shake the word ball. And just whatever word came up, you're supposed to have that inspire your creativity. So we named that show with the word ball. He shook the ball, and the first three words that came up were dynamite, fun, nest. And we were like, that's it. The improv gods have named our...
Yeah.
So the lessons you got there is sort of like a grabby names or whatever. Like.
Yeah, I think that was almost a lesson I got at the Annoyance Theater.
Co-ed
prison sluts, exactly. Yeah. That sounds like a fun show.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And pretty much if you read any of the titles of any show at the Annoyance Theater, it sounded like you got what the show was. It had kind of a hook to it. It sounded fun. And ever since then, I've just been against pretentious names that are just... That's fine for a Herald group, but not for a show. Like, you can have your Herald group have some kind of obscure name, but nobody understands what it means. That's fine. But I think when you name a show, you got to respect... You got to take in the fact that someone out there is reading a newspaper or online these days. There's 100 improv shows. Why are they going to come see yours?
Right.
You got to attract them. If you're not a famous person, why are they going to see your improv show over anybody else's improv show? You know, even within the same theater, why are they going to choose that improv show versus the other one? Like, something's going to attract them. So, and that really has happened over the years. Instead of just saying we're going to do our funny improv show, it's like a hook.
Yeah. Yeah.
Every show has some kind of hook that makes people, you know.
And early on in the UCB, it was things like The Real Real World and like Immortal Kombat. Mm-hmm. You created that too. And
Feature.
Yeah. And who did you create? Who's Holden?
Is that? Yeah.
Yeah. So these are all names that are like.
That was not a great show.
But it's a pretty good title.
Like,
yeah. It's a name that I remember, you know, from the early days. Yeah.
Uh huh. And you know, yeah, like we have. I can't remember the names now, but like Shitty Jobs, I think that's the...
Oh, yeah.
There's no question what that show's about. I get on some level, and everybody... Or Death by Ruru, it's about your bad family. Like, everybody gets... It's
yeah.
It's all-encompassing things that you get. Facebook, what a great hook, you know? And it doesn't make it cheesy. You can still be artful and have a hook. Mm-hmm. But you know,
but it gets an audience, somebody who's looking to see a show to go, oh, okay, I'll see that.
Right. Yeah. Right.
We've skipped around time wise a little bit here.
Yeah.
You want to talk about the formation of the UCB, how you guys all how the original UCB was larger than the UCB 4, right?
Right. But we always it's not like we were always four people and. Neil Flynn did a couple of shows. Rich Fulcher did a couple of shows. Armando was behind the scenes and in front of the scenes in a couple of shows. Ali did a couple. Drew Franklin, I could go on. There's people came in and out. The people who did the most were me, Ian Walsh, and Amy's younger than us. And when she came to town, she joined us. So that's the foursome that we had landed on by the time we decided we wanted to move to New York, have a sketch show, and have it be on Comedy Central.
Well, I don't, this might be the wrong time to ask, but I'm curious what if, when you made the decision that you guys were like good enough to start a theater, I feel like there takes some ego that is, it's got to be a conscious decision at some point. Like, when do you decide that you go to a city, New York City, a huge place, and you're going to be the ones that teach these talented and funny people. You're just going to come in, and you'll be teaching them.
But that's not how it happened at
all. Oh, okay. Well, that's
so. Yeah. We did not have that thought,
okay.
And you're right. We never would have been that presumptuous.
Okay.
We only had one thought, which was we want a show on Comedy Central.
Okay.
And at that point, we didn't even really care about improv. I'd kind of. Improv was my main, in Chicago was my everything.
Yep.
But by the time we were ready to move, it was not. I was like, sketch was my everything.
Right.
That's what I was focused on. That's what we were focused on. We were still
getting
doing
a TV show, doing a sketch.
Right. So once we got here, we were doing two sketch showcases a week, which in retrospect is crazy to think you can get two audiences a week for a sketch show. that's what we were doing, two different theaters. And then since we were working so hard on those sketch shows and they were written and so formalized, we wanted something where we could fuck around more. So we decided to do this ASCAT show too. And we just started doing it for free.
You had done that in Chicago, right? Didn't the name ASCAT, wasn't that born in Chicago or
the
something?
The name was, but the show was born in New York.
Okay.
And there really is no form. I mean, it's just the montage with a monologist.
Right.
Like, you know, it's just like the Armando Diaz, which also wasn't really a groundbreaking form. If anything, it's a lazy form because
right,
we never
people.
Rehearsed together. It was all just good people showing up and doing a montage based on, at first, it was just Armando doing the monologues in Chicago. When we moved out here, it was like, we're not just going to have one person in the monologues. It'll be one of us or a guest. And it was Andy Richter, Sarah Thayer, Eric Sicklin. It was a few different people at first. And then all of a sudden it became a different person every week. But people...
But that was just to supplement the sketch show. The sketch show showcase was your main
focus. It was just for fun.
And we'll do this fuck around just to blow off steam and enjoy it.
In ASCAT, long story short, there was a night... How can I make this short? I had a two-person show at a club in Chicago. The woman who did the show with me didn't show up. She couldn't do the show 1 week, so I asked the guy, can my group come in and do improv? And he was like, yeah, why not? So they came in. They were all drunk off their ass. It was McKay and Horatio and Pat McCartney and Ian and a few other people. And... I don't think I was as drunk as everybody else, but everyone else pretty drunk. We brought like a case backstage. You never play a bar and bring your own case into the bar. That's also a no-no. But the improv was terrible. We were bombing with the audience. At some point, people just stopped stepping out on stage. Oh, back then, we didn't used to use a back line, by the way. That's kind of a new... thing. Back in the day, you'd kind of disappear behind the wings. So the rest of the cast stepped off the wings and just started drinking, and people stopped stepping out after a while. And at one point, I was out on stage by myself, and I think I was building an igloo or something, and I was like, why isn't anyone coming out on stage with me? And then Horatio yells, ASCAT. And he just yells it across the stage, and someone on the other side goes, ASCAT. And I'm just out there, I'm like, fuck if I'm gonna be the dumbass loser out here while everyone's yelling ASCAT. So I step backstage too. So now the stage is empty. The audience is like, what the fuck is going on? And we're just back there cracking up, like laughing till we're crying, yelling ASCAT. The audience eventually is just filing out saying, what the fuck is happening? The owner of the club is pissed at me. He doesn't want me to perform there anymore. But that became the word that was known for when we improvise and we don't give a shit for what the audience thinks. So that became the Tolliver Show in New York. It was like, we're going to do the show for free because you shouldn't make people pay when you're going to not care what they think.
Right.
So we're like, let's just do a show that we don't have to worry about or rehearse for, sweat it out, and we can just show up and fuck around. Not scream ASCAT across an empty stage, but just not sweat it.
Right.
And especially since we were sweating it so hard with the sketch show, which was so important, and there was always someone from the industry there, and we couldn't, it was a serious thing. So this could be our fuck around. So people started seeing that and was like, wow, we've seen sketch, that's nothing new to us, but we've never seen this. We've never seen long form like this. People might think they were doing long form, but they really weren't doing Chicago-style long form. So now we had something. People asked us, we didn't put out an ad to say, come take classes. Like, an improv group came up to us, and I was pretty sure it was Delaney's group was the first.
Lost Footage, right?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they were the first group to ask us, hey, will you coach us? Two or three of us coached them on separate occasions, and now all of a sudden another group did. So now we had two groups coaching us, and now we're like, hey, let's do a class. And now we're doing two classes, and now it's become, and we need money, believe me, so it's a source of income for us too, these classes and these coaching sessions. So we're teaching New York long form. And now we're performing out at Solo Arts at this point. It's a theater that's a five-floor walk-up.
Right. That's when I first saw you guys.
Yeah. And we're renting the space room just about every night of the week. We're playing there two nights. Our ASCAT's there a night. Our grad show's there a night. Now we have a team worthy of having their own night up. And we're just piling out the cash to this guy, renting his place, to the point we realized, look how much money we're spending in a week. That's as much money as a lease for a month. Why are we giving all our money to this guy? So it's just cheaper for us to start our own theater.
So really it was just like a snowball, just like a little something done for fun, beget more success, beget more. So this is like one step
built
out of the other.
From necessity. Like if someone had said to me the day we moved to Chicago, we should start a theater out there, I would have gone, what? No, we don't have time to do that. We're trying to get our sketch group on Comedy Central. We don't have time to start a theater. Don't be ridiculous. So that definitely was not in the plan.
I see.
And we also weren't aware of how little long form was out here, because there were improv groups out here.
Right.
They either were doing short form or they were doing some backwards ass long form. Like Dell had passed through 15 years ago and people were trying to interpret his words or something.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it just wasn't happening. And so, yeah, it was very organic. And yeah, it would have been presumptuous of us to go to a big city and think we could do that.
Was there a point in there, though, that you're like, oh, this is something, so let's put some philosophies in place based on our experiences in Chicago. Let's be this kind of – let's have our classes be like this, you know, things you were talking about, like things you liked about
the
classes or teachers when you were – the four of you, did you talk about – or I don't even know. Like, and when you brought, when you started bringing in other teachers too, like Mulaney – and when Delaney was teaching stuff, were you like, this is the way we're going to do it, and not this way or something?
I don't have as vivid a memory of how serious we became and when. The most serious we've become is in the last few years, really. I'd say the last 5 years is the most serious we've been about codifying. Am I saying that word right?
Yeah.
Codifying our teaching system and actually putting it into a curriculum, getting accreditation, writing a book. But that all came from us going a step further than what the Improv Olympic did as far as focusing on the game. Like, and I think that's the difference between the UCB and the Improv Olympic and maybe other schools, is how important the game became to our school. And we knew from the UCB how important improv that followed the game was to coming up with scenes that are good enough to be written up into a sketch, because that's exactly what we were doing for our show. Mm-hmm. We thought, that's it. That's the way it should be. You should improvise a sketch or improvise a scene that's worthy of being a sketch, and that just seems logical. Like, why would you have any other goal? And if that's your goal, this is the way to do it. I don't know if we ever sat down and thought that, but it's just kind of a philosophy that kind of
But since you were doing shows in this way, that's just the way you guys did it. So when you taught, of course, that's the way you teach it.
Yeah.
And then enough students come through where that's their only improv education, because they're just New York people and there's no real other thing going on, that you look, it's almost like you retroactively look back and realize these decisions you made. You're like, oh, because this is the way we play, that is what we ended up teaching.
And we come from different, like for a way that for a while, I could point back maybe 7 years ago to where I heard people going, well, there's the Ian Roberts way of looking at scenes, and there's the Matt Besser way of looking at scenes. And Ian and I discussed, we're like, what? Because we couldn't be more on the same page about when we break down an improv scene.
Well, you do agree, from my experience seeing workshops from you guys, and I took a number of Ian classes, you do have the same philosophical approach, but you prefer focusing on different things in your classes.
Yeah, he starts out before the premise, and I start out at the premise, pretty much. But people kind of took that as, Besser thinks the only way you can improvise is starting with the premise, and Ian thinks the only way you can start is with yes and. And if you watch him improvise, he rarely starts with yes and.
Right.
He pretty much, like me, always starts with the premise, because we do ASCAT together, we take our premises from the monologues. That's how we do it. So we had to kind of, and you guys remember that, it was kind of like almost a formal announcement to the theater. No, there aren't different philosophies here.
Right.
It's just different ways of teaching the same philosophy, which is good.
Want to talk about the sketch show and just the specifically what I want to talk about is like the what's the best way of saying this? Like the
heraldness of it?
The character the characterization that you guys had, like the you guys had this alter ego, you guys had this chaotic kind of you presented this kind of other world. How far along in working up to the sketch show did that, like, what was the origin of that?
Do you mean like the Upright Citizens Brigade, the fiction of the underground?
The framing device.
Because a lot of the UCB is very like chaos and very underground. So what was the origin of that?
Our very first show in Chicago, it's probably 91, our first official UCB show was called Virtual Reality. Mm-hmm. And this is when virtual reality was something no one had heard of. I don't know how old you guys are, if you guys remember that.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
But it's like that was kind of a new concept, and if you were into cyberpunk, if you're into William Gibson and shit like that, you knew what it was before the rest of the world a little bit, and I was, and so was Adam. And that was one of the things we connected with, and so was Dell, as a matter of fact. That's something we all kind of... We knew what virtual reality was before non-science fiction people knew what it was.
Right.
And then all of a sudden it became a reality that wasn't just in books. They had these big clunky virtual reality machines.
Yeah, like, I remember in arcades they had those.
I did one for $50 for a minute in Las Vegas. It was the craziest experience. It was so shitty. I remember putting these huge helmets and I put it over my head. And I remember it was really heavy and I put it over my head. And when I put it on my head, I was looking down. I'm like, I don't see anything. All I see is green. And the guy was like, it's because you're looking at the grass. He said, look up. And I look up. I'm like, oh, wow. There was a tank coming at me or something. But anyway, the virtual reality was in our fiction was a technology developed by the Russell Corporation, which was a subsidiary of a group called the Upright Citizens Brigade. And this Upright Citizens Brigade was a shadowy secret cabal that influenced the government and was run by corporations. So that was in the fiction of that show. Okay. And meanwhile, we're reading books like Robert Anton Wilson's Illuminati. I don't know if you guys have ever read that.
Yeah.
I've seen it in Anthony Tamminick's bathroom.
It's really worth a read. It's an amazing book.
Yeah.
And or books like Gravity's Rainbow by Pynchon. But there's a lot of those kind of conspiracy heavy reference laden books that we were into. And I think Illuminati in particular really informed the UCB fiction. And we started putting it in every one of our shows that there was this insidious group that was controlling the show, and it was the Upright Citizens Brigade. And we made a program. I made a program that piece of paper, playbill, where I took my grandmother's yearbook from when she went to college. She went to a place called School of the Ozarks. Well, you know, what year was that? Way, way, way back. And there were four professors named Adair, Colby, Trotter, and Antoine. And that was in our playbill, so that's the origin of those names.
Oh, wow.
We have that framed in the back of the theater, I think. That's I've seen that. Photos.
So that's the origin of the names, and that was just in the playbill for probably virtual reality, and they weren't even like characters you ever saw. And then as we went along, those became characters that you eventually saw.
Right.
More in the shows that we brought to New York, even than the ones we did in Chicago. Does that answer the question?
Yes.
It does.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
I'd like, what else do we have here, John? We had good, I don't want to start going off topic. We had some stuff I know we wanted to get to.
You wanted to, this is something that we had talked about shows, shows that people might be surprised. You want to ask this question?
Yeah, this was sort of my idea. So what shows, I guess since you moved to New York and like I'd like to know shows that you were excited by after that experimental period of Chicago. Like, you'd see if you saw comedy shows in New York or L.A. that you're like, this is hilarious. This is, like, a great show. Or something that people might be surprised that you liked. But the surprise thing, now that I say it out loud, I don't know how you would say that. I guess I'm just curious, like, I'm sorry, I'm asking this in the worst way. comedy shows you like that were, like, inspiring to you.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You've already said a couple, like Ed was one, and Blue Velveeta when you first saw it, and groups like that were inspiring.
If you're talking about Chicago, I was way inspired by all those groups. I feel like by the time we moved to New York, I was done being inspired.
Yeah.
I was about...
You were driven.
Performing.
Yeah. Well, how about this?
Yeah. About winning. Let's go up and let's be the best. I wasn't really going out and watching shows. We were trying to perform, and we were being competitive.
Right.
We
so hard on your own stuff that you're not going out there. That's all your time is taken to writing and creating and building towards this Comedy mm-hmm. Central show.
Mm-hmm. Then I'm gonna change my question. I'm gonna make it a statement. See what you think about this. I think because I started taking classes. John and I around the same time, like 2000.
Yeah.
And. What I liked about I still like this about the UCB Theater, what struck me then when I was new to it was it really felt current and young people and like very now. Not like stuck in the past, not like speaking to or beholden to some golden days. It was mm-hmm. like that. This is all now. Mm-hmm. There are good shows tonight and tomorrow night, and the people that are in your class are trying to become good at this or mm-hmm. already are good at this mm-hmm. in a way that is not common. Mm-hmm. You know, you go to stand-up clubs, and there's the veterans who have been on the road, and they've put a lot of time in, and everyone's very isolated, but there was a real community of excitement. And I'm now hearing you speak, I think that's because you guys were the people running the theater were pursuing their own agenda, comedically doing their own thing,
mm-hmm.
and it created sort of a exciting and competitive atmosphere. It's mm-hmm. like, you want to be noticed? Be funny. Be good, and you will be noticed here.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's not like, don't like follow the rules and expect to get like a gold star for being like a diligent student. Like, be a good comedian. That was never said to me in so many words, but that was the feeling like when I went and saw Harold Nider Askat at UCB back then, compared to going to see shows at other theaters or even stand-up clubs. It was cool. Like, I think that was part of what made it successful then. It mm-hmm. felt it felt like you'd found like a little secret place of people kicking ass.
Yeah.
That nobody knew about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I'm not sure if this is wholly what you're saying, but we're talking about this in the press conference yesterday too, that hopefully it's a meritocracy, and I don't need to say which theaters I'm talking about, but I feel like a lot of theaters are about kissing ass in a way. It's like if you stick around long enough, you kiss ass to the right people long enough, you'll eventually move up and get that slot you want. And that I really resented that in Chicago when I saw it, when I saw people who weren't talented succeed and be on the main stage of Second City. I was like, that was frustrating to see that's how things happen. Whereas definitely these days, even maybe more in the earlier days, you don't have to take a class and take five levels to be on our stage here. You know,
right?
You can never take a class at all and be on our stage here.
Right. If you have a good show,
we just try to put the funniest people up. You know, we're not going to put you. I don't know how you're going to get on a Herald team without taking classes with us. That would be pretty miraculous.
I think a Herald team you kind of do, but yeah, to get on the stage, there's other ways. There's room for good people.
But even Harold, don't we let them audition after? We don't make them go through every level before they audition, do they?
We just this year we started out here
because
the numbers got big enough. But for years that wasn't true.
Uh-huh. So, you know, it's just if you can do it, you'll get up. Improv in particular, like you do need those skills. You do need to have the same language. But now we're not an improv theater. We're a sketch,
stand-up
comedy theater. Mm-hmm.
Here's a question. What's made the UCB Theater successful? You guys came out here, you weren't even thinking about opening a theater, you know, at first. And it's just kind of a financial, practical decision that made you get the space on 22nd Street. But now, you look back, this is like an important institution that's a real player in the scene and has produced a lot of famous alumni, mm-hmm. and it's a real active community. And you know, I help run the school here, and there's just like no end to the demand of classes. It seems like people want to take classes here, and it's that was, you know, in 1998, that wasn't true. So what's made it work?
It's like, in spite of not wanting to come here and yeah. make theater, like not having that the furthest away from your mind, you applied those same kind of like principles of being driven and wanting to make everything the best to this thing that you kind of didn't even really intend to have.
Well, first off, we're an all comedy theater, so it literally brings the comedy community together. And I think that's a great thing. Stand-ups and improv used to be completely separate worlds. And even in Chicago, sketch and improv were different worlds. We never did Upright Citizens Brigade Improv Olympic until our last year in Chicago, just because we wanted to keep it separate for some reason. We wanted to be our own thing. So that's one thing. It is a hub for all things comedy. That's our like our one-liner for the theater, but it's true. And there wasn't that. There were stand-up clubs, and there were theater spaces you could rent when we moved here. There was not anything that resembled what this is. The second thing is, when I went to classes in Chicago, I would say half my teachers at least weren't even doing improv. I couldn't see my teachers practice what they preach. I couldn't. I could possibly still be that way. But I think it's great that I'm pretty sure just about every teacher we have is probably doing
something.
An improv show of some sort where you can go watch them and see them practice what they preach. So, and then you can go see a show. You can go see Harold Knight and see it be really great and go, oh. Obviously,
it works.
There's something going on here, you know?
Yeah.
And the success rate, I think, is just better than what it was. The Herald teams of our, I'd put the Herald teams of our school against the Herald teams of my generation anytime. I would say our school's Herald teams are going to kick ass on the Herald teams of the past in Chicago. Maybe not current Chicago. I'm not talking about you now. I don't know what's going on there now. But, I think it's kind of like, remember American Idol, the first couple of seasons? Yeah. There was always like shitty singers. You're like, I can sing as good as that guy.
Yeah.
But now you don't think that. Every single finalist,
one
way or another, can really sing really well.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's, I think there was a lot of mediocre improv, and I don't think there is a lot of mediocre improv now.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I mean, I think like the quality's gone way up.
Yeah.
I always liked it, but it's as the community's grown and you're pulling from a larger...
It only makes sense.
Yeah.
You talk a lot. You talked in the press conference about this yesterday. You talked about it today. And I know that you're big on premise and playing with premise. So I wanted to try to talk to you a little bit about that.
Yeah, I noticed a tweet that went out from our own theater's Twitter account.
Uh-oh.
Did you do it?
That's me.
That's
what you said.
Yeah, but when you put it in that
hey man,
small,
that's good journalism.
When you put it in 140 characters, I don't hate Yes Ands. You know I don't hate Yes Ands.
I know you don't hate it, but that's what you said, though.
But three years ago, you guys did
I use the word hate?
Yes.
You did say Yes Ands was overrated 2 years ago.
Yes.
That was your official statement.
Well, that's in our book.
You said, I like to play premise because I hate Yes And. That's what you said.
Well, you can clarify now. What's the point that you were...
I said I hate Yes Anding, which I think is a little different than saying I hate Yes And, because that implies I don't like the concept.
I will modify the tweet once we get out of this interview.
But you know what I mean? It's a difference between saying... what's the comparison? Just because I don't like fly fishing doesn't mean I'm against fly fishing.
Yeah.
Just because I don't do it well or I can't do that cast they do doesn't mean that I think fly fishing is lame and shouldn't be done. I just prefer to fish with live bait.
Do you think that you don't yes and well? Or you?
I don't need to.
Okay.
because the form I do, I don't need to. So
the form
I just
you do being ASCAP.
Right. That's the only improv form I do. Mm-hmm. And it's been such a long time. I've never enjoyed starting with a suggestion and starting the scene right away.
Would you up for it? What if you did it for
a fun show? We did it 3 years ago in the marathon.
Oh, that's right.
And it went well.
Yeah.
I don't mind doing it. Mm-hmm. That's the opposite of hate, I guess. I just prefer not to. To me, it's like, why do it if you don't have to?
Right.
Like, I feel like that's not the fun part. I start having fun. That probably would have been the better way to put it. Uh-huh. Like, I don't have fun yes anding. Like, when you tweeted, I hate yes and, that implies that I don't agree with the concept.
Yeah. That's so, the building block of everything.
What's funny is that as I was tweeting that, I was like, maybe I should, maybe this is not the best way of saying this. But
it's fun.
Yeah. I hate short form. Like, that's why I said, did I say hate? Because it's not hate.
Well, it's also
it's just
recorded.
Like, it's like what? It's like, why do that if you don't have to? That's right. Always been my philosophy.
So what makes a good, how do you get to a good premise? Like, what makes a good premise for you?
A good opening. Opening makes a good premise.
A good monologue or a good opening of any kind?
Yeah. That's why I'm obsessed with openings. I mean, if you've taken my class, you know I'm overly obsessed with openings.
Yeah, you
I feel
love...
like if you can do a good opening, you don't have to do yes anding, which is difficult, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and why make improv difficult? I never understand that.
Right.
If you're not cheating, then why make it difficult? It should just be as it should. We should get to playing with the premise as quickly as possible. I don't understand why you wouldn't want to.
As a teacher, this falls on me as a teacher probably more than anything, but when we get to the point in the class where we teach openings and initiating with premise, mm-hmm. there's always, I feel like, a fall off of agreement in the right after that. Like, people are in their heads more trying to come up, they're listening to the opening for a pretty evolved idea, and that's new to them. That, you know, that's kind of difficult for their brains. And then I have to, whatever we have taught them about just like listening and yes-anding and using what the other person is saying degrades for a little while until they can kind of do both. Like, until they can kind of like be processing the opening as an idea and then still be really investing in what the other person is saying. It's pretty consistently.
How many people do you think... Let's take a good improv group. Take any really good improv group where you think everyone's good.
Okay.
Don't you think there's a possibility that there's a good number of people on that group that are good at improv?
Yeah.
But if you told them the way you do with your students to break down what a premise is, they would not be good at that. You know what I'm saying? If you said, tell me what the premise is, even though they're great at improvising, they're not good at analytically...
Like articulating it. After
right,
the fact.
Right.
Yeah, that's true. Some people are
my
good at that.
My guess is those people are also not the strongest sketch writers. And they might... I think premise people, the people who prefer premise improv are generally make better sketch writers.
Makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Whereas people who are like prefer the organic and yes-anders, they organically fall into the premise but don't... If put up against a wall and made to say what that premise is, they couldn't.
Yeah.
But within
they can feel it.
They can feel it. They know what to do.
Yeah.
So that's just the difference right there.
Yeah.
And it's not good or bad. It's just it's just how your brain works.
Right.
I've always said that if you gave the analogy test on the SAT analogy test, I think people who did analogies better would be better at premise improv. I've always thought that.
I think that's right.
Because
it's definitely like analogous beats and just like abstracting an idea to a couple simple terms.
Exactly.
The same muscle.
Exactly. So it's just, it doesn't mean they're smarter. It just means it's their brain works works in that way. And that's why I always try to make it clear. Premise improv, is it better than organic? Organic's not better than premise. I think organic people think premise people are cheating. Premise people think organic people are wasting their time or whatever, but it's just like it's whatever works.
Most great improv
really.
Teams have both. Most great improv teams have somebody who's like can feel it and they're going on they wouldn't be able to articulate it so well if you stopped and made them say it. But they don't make a wrong move when it's in motion.
Right.
And there's other people on that team who, when it's getting foggy, they can like lay down a line that like clarifies the game plan in a good way.
That's what makes for good balance, you know, in a team.
Yeah, I liked what you said yesterday about people should admire teams and not performers, because that's what it's about.
Yeah, that always bugs me. Who's your favorite improviser? It's like, come on.
Yeah.
If you're pointing out your favorite, that you don't get it to me.
Things you've said here about like your experiences have, this is what I see as a big part of this theater. Competitiveness, like being good enough, is like I think a welcome part of the culture. Not to be like unfriendly, but just to be like you do have to be competitive to be good enough for an audience to watch you. You have to like embrace the idea that you have to work hard and be better than other people to earn the attention of whoever's in the audience.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that, see, I know that this is a comedy theater, but improv is still associated hugely with the UCB because of ASCAT and because of your guys' background. And improv, so many people just associate it like with group mind and all these things that like kind of feel counterintuitive to being competitive and being aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
That the UCB is different that way. It says, no, we believe in group mind. We do believe in using what your partner is saying and being
don't
subservient
to
the
compete with
whole.
Each other.
Yeah.
Compete
but the,
with
en-
the,
but the entity that you're making should be a competitive. This place is unique, I think, in that it does encourage kind of like the group hug sort of aspect of improv, group mind, but also introduces an aggressiveness of, oh, but be funny. Like, think about that. Was your show funny? That's what you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, I'm not saying don't be artful, but if it wasn't funny, you didn't do your job.
Right.
I think, it's very unique.
If you get off stage
here.
And you're just like, we had a fun time. You had a fun time or a funny time? I want you to add an NY to that line. Because I don't go to a show to watch people have fun.
So I think like the thing that you were experiencing with like Corky's callback versus a victim's family still exists in that form.
Yeah.
People.
I think we were
a
little more brutal back then.
Yeah.
But because we were vicious. I don't know if other people would admit to that, but I know people were. It wasn't just me. The teams were viciously competitive with each other. And I think now, I don't know. You tell me. Do you think the teams are viciously
competitive? No, I think they're excited to see each other do well.
Yeah,
I think
they respect. I mean, no one likes to. Everyone wants to be the best.
Right.
You're bummed to see someone do what you think is better.
But you don't have Schadenfreude when the other team bombs, probably.
Actually, I do think they.
I
have
think
that.
There's.
Do they?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's competitiveness still amongst.
If
Harold
a team
teams.
Gets regarded as the top Harold
oh, yeah,
team and
absolutely.
You see them bomb, I think you're kind of like good. Eat shit for a while.
Especially
I think that happens.
Like, I've been in situations where it's like. You know, you're on a Harold team, and there's another Harold team that's considered, like, great, and everybody loves them, and you and your Harold team are like, what the fuck is, why are they so fucking good? What the fuck are they doing?
I mean,
right?
I'm on the Stepfathers. I get insecure about how funny the other weekend teams are. When I see Law Firm or Ruru or Curfew Now, Ruben Williams, kill it, I'm like, are we that good?
There's
fuck,
less.
Man, we better be that good.
Now, like, with the team that I'm on, I've gotten to a place personally where I don't give as much of a shit.
It's not as brutal as what you're describing.
Right, it's not, but there were times, like in other teams I was on previously, where we looked at the people who were the darlings of Harold Knight and like, the fuck are they doing that's so fucking funny? You know, why does everybody love them?
It does, there is that path.
Yeah. And as long as you're, you know, I sound like a self-help guru, like The Secret, but as long as you're putting that energy into making your group better, that's a good thing, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree.
I think another thing, the UCB Theater is different from other comedy places, is that there's a community associated with it. Like, I took classes at other improv theaters first in New York. And I liked them okay. It was all new to me. Everything was kind of exciting. But I'd never... You took class, you went home, that was it. You saw their show that was kind of the same all the time, and you were alone. Here, I took Level 1 with Kevin Mullaney. We all went to McManus after, and then we all went to Harold Knight on Thursday. And then, like, we all went to see whatever was up at the Marooned and Naked Babies, whatever was up on that weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like a world you were in.
Yeah.
Welcome. It was great.
Yeah.
Like-minded people, every level.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so I was had never thought of myself as a performer. It took a long time for me to get confidence to be a performer. But long before I had that, I felt like I was part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that's – maybe it wasn't by design. That maybe that's like inherited from I.O. Improv Olympic kind of sounds like that. that there is like a society of UCB. It's not just the four of you, and it's not even just the performers on the stage. There's like a whole world around it who identify with it greatly. And as it's gone on for years, people from people when they leave and they go on to do something else, they consider themselves part of the UCB. Like I'll get calls from people who haven't taken classes in 5 years and kind of miss it and want to get back in somehow. And that doesn't mean get on the stage necessarily. They just kind of like they
want
to
get back. Yeah, they want that community.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's unique to this place. I think the $5 ticket price and cheap beer has a lot to do with that.
Oh, yeah.
You don't have to pay like $15 and for two like $12 drinks to watch a show.
Yeah.
$5 you can see all of Harold Knight.
Yeah, the same thing that makes performers feel comfortable trying out things and developing their voice on the stage also makes audience members and people interested in being a part of it comfortable coming here and watching stuff. Yeah.
I agree.
Classes, you get thrown in pretty early here too. Classes move quick. You were talking about how like in Players Workshop, there's like a whole, you know, a lot of object work and slow, such baby steps that there's really no movement.
And it wasn't even steps. Like we're walking around in a circle. Like I mean metaphorically, like I didn't feel like second level was so much more advanced. It just seemed like whatever teacher I had basically. I had one teacher at Second City that they put me with twice, and I knew I was a better improviser than she was.
Yeah.
It's like I saw her improvise, like, she doesn't know what she's doing, and I'm going to her for 16 weeks of advice. This is crazy.
I remember my first class here, first day, we were doing scenes at the end of the first class. You were up on stage getting a suggestion, and they weren't great. It was Mulaney, and he was just trying to show us what it felt like. Kevin Mulaney was a very nice person. He wasn't like, this wasn't like a make you feel bad lesson. This was just a, here's what we're going to be doing. Let's not be scared of it. Let's do it now. It was fun. It was exciting.
My first improv class, we were doing Krav Maga by the end of the...
really?
Boy. Well, it was...
Anyway.
Yeah.
That's not in our curriculum anymore.
Right, right. But...
it's funny to me...
Go ahead.
How much that... Like, some of that's got to be... There must have been a decision. Like, let's have cheap shows. There must be a decision at some point, like let's be aggressive in what we teach. Like let's the same way Dell might just talk to a lot of his advanced. He didn't care who he was talking to. He was speaking what was on his mind. We don't do to that extreme, but there is an element.
The $5 show comes from Discord Records used to have on the back of their records. It said, and I loved this. It would always say, I don't know if they still do this. But it'd say, don't pay more than $6 for this record. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah.
They had these little labels they used to put on the back of their vinyl records. So if you went to a punk store, those stores knew not to, for Discord, for Minor Threat, don't overcharge. You know, without question, the original point of the theater was, why are we wasting our money and let's start a space where there's no hassle that we've been getting at all the spaces we rent around town. Like, we couldn't store our props there, or, you know, you can't get on the stage until the minute you start renting it. Like, oh, it was just so lame and a hassle to get a place, other places. So when we got a place, it was like our number one goal isn't to make money, and we've yet to personally make any money. It was all about people in the audience. So we're not going to charge the same prices they charge at a comedy club. We're not going to charge the same prices they charge for a movie. And that was our original thing. Let's be less than it costs to go see a movie. And at the time we started, that wasn't as large a gap. Now it's a huge gap.
Yeah.
Now it's like...
More than double.
Yeah, or three times less. So that's where it came from, was let's have asses in the seats. That's the most important thing.
Right.
I think punk rock had the same thing. Let's get as many listeners as possible. Let's not alienate all these kids that listen to our music by charging $18 for a CD.
Right.
Well, I think it worked.
Our asses in the seats.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
I wish this wasn't such a big question. Here's what I would ask next if we had time, which is the impact of the LA theater, because I think that's when stand-up really became part of the culture.
Mm-hmm.
The stand-up community out there was such a big part of the LA community that it made the New York theater... We already did have stand-up and stuff like that, but it changed the identity of UCB to being more than just ASCAT.
Yeah, when I moved to LA... Before the rest of the UCB did, obviously the theater wasn't there. And I had to get back into the stand-up scene, which was, oh my God, it was so depressing and dark. It was almost like I was starting over again. You know, it was almost like I'd never been on television before. I went to this open mic in a little tiny coffee shop where you couldn't fit more than 10 people in the audience. And I went up to the lady who ran the open mic. And I'm like, hey, I'm at bat. She's like, oh yeah, I know you from your Upright Citizens Brigade. I'm like, yeah, I'm a big fan. I really like your show. Oh, thanks. I'm like, can I get on the list here? And she said, yeah, but first I'll need to see a tape of you doing stuff. And I'm like, oh, my God. Ugh,
Jesus.
I'm in a coffee shop talking to someone who actually knows that I have done legitimate stuff, and I still need to prove to her that I can.
Ugh.
It was gross. So frustrating and gross and. So I did get back in that scene. I started to see some of the guys I'd started out with, like those guys I named earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me think, yeah, we need to have a theater that brings all these different things together.
Yeah.
And like I did the show last night with Doug Benson, who's become a new friend of mine since I moved to L.A. And that's such a perfect example of a show. His Doug I Loves Movies, or even his...
Benson Interruption.
Those are both perfect examples of the kind of shows that bring all types of comedic performers together. And I think that's just such a great thing, because stand-ups get sick of just doing stand-ups. Improvisers get sick of just doing improv. And it's great to have those hybrid shows that are fun for everyone, whether it's a talk show or a game show or something weird that's in the middle.
Yeah.
Right.
We can wrap it up here, even though I feel like I could talk to you for another 2 hours about stuff and about May I Help You Dumbass and nerd out about Stung.
Or even pick a particular show and talk about the thought that went into that.
But I will also say that, you know, when you're first learning improv, you, like, watch people who, like, have what you want and then try to emulate that. I will say my first couple of years doing improv, I did a lot of very clumsy improv in an attempt to emulate the stuff that you were doing on stage.
Thank you.
You know, because you try to emulate it, but you're just not good at it yet, so you get out there and do what you think is that. But thanks for sitting down with us.
Thanks for spending this time.
Awesome.
We like getting, we're technologically challenged about doing interviews from LA yet, so it's nice to take advantage of the time when you're here in New York. So I'm glad we got to do this.
Thanks, guys. Thanks,
Matt.
Listeners.
Yeah, listen to us next week, probably, for another episode, which will be number 41, John.
All right, I'll try to remember that.
All right, goodbye, everybody.
Bye.